Welcome to Building Fortunes Radio. Make sure you check us out at buildingfortunesradio.com. Along with our marketing partners, we're here to help our PM Marketing Network Lead customers build their businesses and make the world a better place. At Building Fortunes, we know how much your business means to you and the people important to you. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world. Now on to our show with your host, Peter Mingles.
Hello everyone, Peter Mingles here. You are listening to us on Building Fortunes Radio. It's www.buildingfortunesradio.com. It's 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We never do this radio show at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, but we do this one because we have a special guest on with Scott Johnson. This is Scott Johnson's radio show. We usually do this radio show live on Sunday nights at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 on the Central side, so we're a little bit earlier. But if I may, we always post these radio shows back up on buildingfortunesradio.com. So if you go to buildingfortunesradio.com and you look for Scott Johnson, or you do buildingfortunesradio.com/Scott-Johnson, you'll be able to hear this radio show. Or Scott's going to give you his website in just a second, and I know he has a link to this radio show as well. So the way this whole thing got started many years ago, Scott called me up after a radio show that I did with Roger Van Vlissingen. I'm going to keep my intro short because we have a special guest today. And through that really neat conversation I had with Scott, we started talking about the tool scam associated with MLM. And you can listen to the other radio shows about that. But we started to do this, and I said, Scott, let's do some radio shows together so we can talk about that. And it wound up being, or this is actually wound up being, one of our longest-running radio shows on Building Fortunes Radio. I've been doing this one specifically since 2015, and as a result of that, if you listen to enough shows, you'll pick up a lot of things that you'll need to know if you want to navigate through the home-based business arena. We touch on just about everything, everything directly related to MLM, indirectly related to MLM, stuff you never thought was related to MLM, and even some of the anti-MLM stuff as well. So I'm going to kind of step out of the way as fast as I can, introduce Scott so he can introduce this special guest, and you can always pick this up again. If you missed us live, you can always pick it up again on the replay on buildingfortunesradio.com. So, Scott, thanks for being here on your own radio show.
Hey, Peter, thanks for having me. Yeah, we do have a great guest tonight, and I'm really looking forward to hearing some things from an HR perspective, and there's a lot of things going on, even things I didn't realize were going on. So yeah, you're right. We got together in September of 2015, and I was looking for a place that I could put my voice out there as far as talking about MLM, and particularly Amway's tool scam, because I was at Amway for several years. Then I realized I was being scammed by the tools, and I've been talking about it ever since 2005. So it was great to have this outlet to be able to put my views out there. And let's talk about what is the Amway tool scam, or other MLMs like Herbalife that have tool scams. What it is, it's the distributors, the higher level distributors, sometimes the company, but it's usually the distributors. They sell various things. They sell books. They sell, you know, recordings, you know, audio and video recordings. They have various meetings, different sizes of meetings across the country. They have phone apps now. They have voicemail. They have website access. Very high profitability. They make most of their money from those tools and not from Amway. And that's very well documented on my websites that I have showing exactly how much they make, because what happens over the years is some of them start talking. And when I say them, it's not people that are in Amway. It's people that got kicked out of Amway, and they just start talking. And I've looked for those examples and put them all on my website so that people can see that it's not just me making these claims. It's the people that were actually making that money before they got kicked out, and then they just start squealing. So if you go to my Facebook page, that's where I've got, you mentioned, Peter, the link to this radio show and all the previous 8.5+ years of weekly radio shows, as well as 3 websites I have, my YouTube. I've got a link there to a Vimeo recording that's interesting. I'll leave it at that. And also my email and phone number. It's all right there on the Facebook page. So if you go to facebook.com/ScottTexJohnson, that's ScottTexJohnson, that's where you'll find all of these resources of information. Now, what makes that tool scam a scam isn't that they're making the money. I don't have a problem with people making money at all. We're pro-business. But what they do is they don't talk about that they're making that money while they're in. They give every indication that their success, financial success, came from Amway. And most of it actually came from these tools. And so they lie by omission about that fact. And that's what I try to educate people on, and how wrong that is, how unethical, immoral. I believe it's illegal. I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's legal fraud. It's at least business fraud, where you don't describe the entire business model, only the part that you want people to hear. And so that's the tool scam. Now, that's not a problem that's with every MLM. But another problem is either with every MLM or most of them, and that is the lack of retail sales. And it's caused by several factors. The main one is the prices of the products are overpriced, and so it's very hard to find customers. And so most of the consumption is done by the distributors, you know, the internal consumption, not the external customer purchases. That's the actual definition of an illegal pyramid. And that's very well documented through the years. The FTC has gone after, unfortunately, a very small handful of the over 600 or 700 MLMs in the United States alone. They've only gone after a very small handful, but every time they've gone after them, with the one exception, the recent exception of Niora, they've won. And I won't go into the Niora situation because we do want to get our guest on here. But basically, they picked on an MLM that was able to show the judge that they did have retail sales. Now, whether they actually had them or not is still a question in my mind, but now that's how the trial went. That's where we are with that. So those are the two big problems. You know, I think we often say on this show, Peter, you know, we're not pro-MLM, we're not anti-MLM. You know, we're pro-MLM if it's being done right, and we're anti-MLM if it's being done wrong, and we define what the wrong is. You know, the wrong is lack of retail sales, which equals an illegal pyramid, and tool scams, which I think is RICO fraud or at least business fraud. And so those are the two big things we like to talk about briefly at the beginning of the shows for the new listeners so they can know where we're coming from and understand, you know, why we're not either a fervent pro-MLMer or a fervent anti-MLMer, that we're just saying, hey, there's some objective things here. Now, in my opinion, if you fixed every other issue with MLM, and there's others, you won't make much progress because these are the two big ones. And so that's why we focus on these two big ones. I would have to say that even any non-MLM business out there is not perfect because it's populated by humans, and humans are not perfect. So, you know, we're not trying to go for perfection here. We're just saying, hey, there's two really big problems in this MLM industry, and it would be nice for people to cooperate and coordinate and the government to wake up and to make these changes and enforce these kinds of things. But I digress. I wanted to introduce our guest, who is an HR specialist, human resources. And I found her, I think it was on Instagram, or maybe it was LinkedIn, I think it was, Wendy. And I just tripped across her. And one of the subjects that I wanted to discuss with her is the recent movement, I guess we could say, in the reanalysis of what is considered an employee versus what is considered an independent contractor. And of course, everybody that's a distributor, you know, we're not talking about the MLM employees, but anyone that's a distributor in an MLM is categorized as an independent contractor, which is, you know, an IRS definition, and it allows the company to basically, you know, pay you for your services, but typically there's not the other benefits that an employee has, things like, you know, medical, dental, vision, insurance, vacations, those kinds of things. You're an independent contractor. You work as much or as little as you want. It's up to you. And that's the basic difference in my understanding. Of course, I'm not an expert, but that's my understanding of what the basic difference is between employees and independent contractors. And I just want to bring in Wendy Sellers, who is an HR specialist. She does it, I believe, as a consultant now. But Wendy, tell us a little bit about your background, you know, as much as you want to share where you're from, what your background is as far as your work history and how you became an HR consultant. And welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Sure. Hi, everybody. It's Wendy Sellers. I'm known as the HR lady. That's the name of my business. I have been in HR probably way longer than I care to admit, but I'll go with 2.5 decades. And I've honestly randomly ended up in HR is not what I originally went to college for. And I fell in love with it and went back and got another degree in human resources. So I have all the certifications, all of that stuff. I have dealt with when I was in corporate America, because I own my own business now, and, you know, I help companies of all sizes, but a lot of my smaller clients, they're too small to have human resources, right? And so I help them with all their HR functions and get them set up so that they don't break any laws and that they know, you know, what's legal, what's illegal, and then what's the right thing to do. And on top of that, the main part of what I really do these days is I do management training, because whether you have a human resource department or not, your managers are really your frontline HR. You know, they know what's going on with their employees, and or they should know. So I do a lot of management training and help managers understand, okay, this is how you interview people, this is how you promote people, this is how you pay them, all of that stuff. So about me personally, I live in St. Pete, Florida. I've been in Florida, but I've been in St. Pete for about 2.5 years, and I absolutely love it. It is paradise. What going to talk about this new independent contractor rule. So it's so confusing because there was an independent contractor rule forever, and then it changed, and then it changed again. It changed in 2021, and now it's changed as of March of 2024. They changed the rules about who can be an independent contractor. Why are they changing this, and why do we care? So as you were just kind of saying, you know, hey, somebody might want to be an independent contractor, and they might want to work, you know, on their own, work weekends, nights, whatever. They set their own rules. It's not up to the individual to determine if they're an independent contractor, which is also known as a 1099, or a W-2 employee. It's up to the law. So somebody comes to your company and they're interviewing for a job, and if they just say, oh, I want to be an independent contractor, you can't say as an employer, okay, no problem, because if it's an officially a W-2 employee job, whether you both agree on the contractor situation or not, it's up to the law. Does that make sense?
Yeah, total sense. Yeah.
So,
go ahead.
No,
so, yeah,
your explanation makes sense. Your explanation makes sense, but the reality doesn't make sense. But the reality doesn't count. So you're right. Your explanation is perfect.
Yeah, it really, you know, and so many people are like, oh, you want to be a contractor? Sure, okay, great. Now we don't have to pay you overtime or anything like that. Yeah, you can set your own schedule, but we're still going to tell you what you have to do. So if you're telling an employee, a worker, you know, how to do things, when to do them, they have a schedule, they have to work in person or home, whatever. If you're basically telling them what to do and how, they're probably going to be an employee, even if they agree to it. And the reason it's like this is because most people get taken advantage of. you know, most employees who are, who become independent contractors, they, oh, this sounds cool, I work for myself. And it's like, well, it might sound cool and you might think you have some flexibility, but in the end, you're not getting any benefits. So you're not getting unemployment tax paid for you. So if you lose your job, you're done. You can't even get unemployment. You're not getting any of the benefits that the company either by law has to give the employee, or, you know, if the company has the health care insurance or PTO or something like that, well, a contractor doesn't get that. So like I said, a lot of workers who agree to be an independent contractor, they don't realize that. They just think it's really cool, I work for myself, but then they're missing all of those benefits, including taxes, you know, Medicare wages being paid, you know, all those little tiny marks on your payroll, your paycheck, that you're like, oh, I didn't realize I was paying the government all this. Well, the employer pays for half and you pay for half. Well, if you don't have an employer anymore because you're a contractor, then guess what? You got to pay for it all. You don't get the benefit at all. So, you know, there's a big picture here that's way bigger than most people realize about the independent contractor thing. So not to go backwards, I have a YouTube video out on my YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. You can just Google Wendy Sellers, the HR lady, and I have a ton of YouTube videos. But there is a YouTube video, I want to say I made it in January of 2024, about explaining this independent contractor situation. Who cares what happened in 2021 or before, because it is all complicated. But right now, the Department of Labor has put in, effective March of 2024, a six-point economic reality test is what it's called. So it's the six-point Department of Labor's application of the economic reality test. And that test, as of right now, 2024, is what matters. So that's what we as employers or workers have to understand to say, yes, I can be an independent contractor, or no, I can't. So I'll just go over the six things real quick. And the biggest thing I want you to know, though, is it's not, no single factor is bigger than another factor. So no single factor is what they call controlling. So if there's like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and you're saying, okay, we have 4 out of the 6, it's still every single independent contractor situation has to be taken on an individual basis. So it's a lot more work for the employer and the employee or independent contractor in theory to decide, okay, should I be a contractor or should I be an employee with all these benefits, including our overtime? So
and
the
Wendy,
first thing,
Wendy, my understanding is the change from 2021 is back in 2021, there was 2 of those 6 factors that were controlling, and now they're all co-equal. And so it makes it, in my mind, more jumbled up because, you know, you could have, like you say, 5 out of 6 of these things that looks like it should be a independent contractor, for example, but then the 6th one says, nope, it's got to be an employee. And that one factor, if all the surrounding circumstances dictate that that person needs to be assigned as an employee, then that's what has to happen. But it's very, in my mind, very subjective. Is that kind of your understanding as well? Is every case is unique and you have to look at all of the different factors on each individual situation?
Yeah, so it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 is the situation. I gotta grab a water here. Hold on 1 second.
But yeah, go ahead and cover those 6 things if you'd like to, because these are the 6 things that will define whether somebody is an independent contractor or an employee. Again, subject to all of the different factors that go into it, all of the different inputs, so to speak.
So the first one is, and this is, I think this one's probably an easiest one to figure out. Number one is the extent to which the services, so the work, is integral part of the employer's business. So if it's, let's just say an accounting role and it's not an accounting company, then it's probably not an integral part of the business, but it still doesn't mean that it's, you know, that accountant is not an independent contractor. So that's just an easy one for me to explain. But if it's, you know, you're integral and the business cannot do their work without your service, then you're going to be an employee. So that's number one. I think that one's the easiest one.
Let me ask you from an MLM perspective. The distributors are the ones that purchase all of the products and services that an MLM offers. Now, there are some MLMs now that are starting to branch out into, you know, things like customers can directly contact their website and buy products from that angle. But most MLMs, my understanding at least, is almost all of the products and services are purchased through the distributors. Now, would that tend to make those people an employee versus an independent contractor?
It's not so much about the sales. It's about what does the person, the worker, do. So let me go through the six of them, and then let's jump back to that, okay?
Okay.
So
sounds
the first
good.
One is, again, if they're an integral part of the business, then that's number one. The second one is the amount of the so-called the workers' investment in facilities and equipment. So if they have to, you know, buy their own computer, they have to, I don't know, buy their own website in the case that you're talking about. If they're investing in their own equipment, they're going to be leaning more towards a contractor. But I caution just jumping to that conclusion because a lot of employees are just very passionate about what they do. That's why they're in that career. And then they bring their stuff from home to help them out in the work business. They'd still be a W-2 employee, though. But the more that they're going to be investing in their own, like their own equipment to do the job, an office or, you know, a company truck, something like that, they're probably going to be more of a contractor. But I know so many people that bring their own things from work, like, oh, yeah, I have that at home. So I'm so passionate about what I do. So I'll just bring it to my company and work there. In theory, again, theory here, an employee, so I'll just use the tax abbreviations, a W-2, which is, you know, their payroll, a W-2 employee, anything that they're using for their job, the employer should be providing. But you and I know that that's not always the reality, right? So first thing is it integral to the employer's business? Second, who's investing what in the facilities and the equipment? Third one is the nature. Go ahead.
I was just going to interrupt real quick because I'll forget these if you go to all six. the computer is an interesting example. I know there's other things, you know, that go into all of that, not just the computers. But, you know, a lot of companies these days insist that you use their computer because they have all of their, cyber protections and, you know, all those kinds of things are built into the computer, and you're not even allowed to bring in your own computer, you know, from an IT cybersecurity point of view. But, of course, you know, there's people out there with other tools, you know, sometimes literal physical tools like shovels and hammers and so forth. So it's not just computers, but that was an interesting example, and I just thought of that, you know, off the top of my head when you mentioned computer. And how employers often insist on providing that particular piece of equipment. So go right ahead.
And they should. They really should. If there's ever a worker that is an actual employee and not a contractor, you shouldn't be having them use their own computer. You shouldn't be having them using their own cell phone, the one that I'm speaking on right now. It should all be provided by the employer or somehow financially. So that's why you see like a lot of companies will say, okay, employee, you have to have a company phone. So now they're carrying two phones, or they say, or we'll pay part of your bill so that you just use your personal phone. So that's kind of one of the reasons there too. Same thing with the computer as well. So facilities and equipment, whose is it? That will help decide if they're a contractor or an employee as the second thing. The third thing is what is the nature and the degree of control by the principal? So the principal is the employer. So meaning, it, like I mentioned before, is the employer, the company, telling the worker when you're going to work, where you're going to work, how you're going to work, how you're going to, you know, build that project, how you're going to build a website, for example, or is this going to be, yep, have it, this is my deadline, have it done by then, don't really care how you do it. Now, there could be some guidance, obviously, because if you're hiring somebody to build a website, for example, you're still going to tell them, hey, this is what I want the end results to look like, and here are my factors, and that's, if you can do these factors, then I'll hire you over somebody else. But the more control or bossiness that the employer has over the worker, it's leaning more towards an employee.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. These, as you go through these are all very subjective. There's all kinds of, you know, shades of color here as far as, you know, it's not one extreme or the other. It's often in between somewhere. And somehow you have to navigate all six of these factors and figure out, because at the end you have to make a digital decision, right? A one or a
yep.
zero, employee or a contractor. There's no middle ground on the final result of this analysis. So
right. You have to make a decision. Yeah, and no single factor is more important than the other is what it is.
Right.
So, you know, and it's not that it's not even that they're equally important. You know, it's very, very confusing. And then on top of that as well, just talking about, you know, you need to have this decision made before you start interviewing, because if it turns out to be an independent contractor, they're probably going to want more money than when they were an employee, because as an employee, the employer is paying taxes for them, whereas a contractor, they're not. They're not paying taxes for them. You know, they're not paying, you know, unemployment insurance, Social Security, Medicare, all of that stuff, and then all, any benefits that you might happen to have. So you do need to have this decision made, I would say, before you put like a job ad out, so to speak. And then you need to say if they're going to be, it's an ad for a contractor or an ad for an employee. The fourth one is, I think, a little bit easier to understand, like number one and number four, is an opportunity for profit and loss. And so what that means is, you know, as an independent contractor, you're basically in business for yourself. Well, when you're in business for yourself, you have a huge opportunity to make money, right? But then you have an opportunity, unfortunately, to lose money, and there's nothing you can do about that. Like if somebody just says, nope, you're done, I don't want you to be my independent contractor anymore, there's nothing you can do. You go, okay, I got to go find more work. If you're an employee, you know, there's probably steps that they have to go through to before they terminate you, so to speak. And also, generally speaking, if you're hiring full-time employees, even if there's no work, you're still got to pay them if they show up every day. Where with the independent contractor, if they don't do the job, they just don't get paid, period. So
right,
that one to
right.
me is a little bit easier to understand for the opportunities for profit and loss.
If you're an at-will state, then, you know, your employer can, at least my understanding, theoretically, can fire you for any reason or no reason at all. They don't have to tell you why. They just say goodbye.
Yeah, so every state in the United States except one is an at-will employment state. The only exception is Montana. So unless you're in Montana, every state is at-will employment. So what that means is that the employee or the employer could end it at any time. For any reason, the employee can walk away at any time, and the employer can terminate you at any time for any reason, as long as it's not an illegal reason. If you were my client, I would say, I would want you to still tell these people why you're terminating them. Otherwise, they're going to make something up in their head and to turn around and sue you, you know,
right.
and it's going to go nowhere, but it's going to cost money and, you know, end up on social media and be in the news. So, thank you for bringing up the at-will employment part of that. And then
surprised
that,
only Montana is not at-will. I figured some of the, you know, the more liberal states would still be not at will. That is interesting, because Montana is kind of a independently minded, you know, similar to where you live now, Florida, Texas, Arizona. Those are the states that I kind of view as, you know, kind of independent thinking more than most of the other states. And yet in Montana also, and yet Montana is the only one that's not at will. That's really interesting.
But the interesting thing, though, about the Montana one, because it is confusing, honestly, that even though they're not officially an at-will state, there's an act called the Wrongful Discharge from Employment Act, so it's not going to apply in Montana. However, Montana has this interesting thing that says once you've completed an established probationary period, and I think it's 90 days, I don't know off the top of my head, then the employer still needs to have good cause termination. So Montana, yeah, it's interesting that Montana, which is a very conservative state, takes the other way, another way around. So I don't know why it's like that. Can't believe it's still like that. But getting back to what we were talking about, though, is the opportunity for profit and loss. It's with pretty much the entire country, right? With an employee or with a contractor. But if you're an independent contractor, typically you have a couple clients. And so there's your opportunities for profit and loss. If your only client is this employer, do you really have an opportunity for profit or loss? Probably not. So that's the interesting thing there. They take that into consideration too. Like, well, how many clients do you have? You know, because that's gotcha. Where the opportunity for profit and loss. Because if you only have one client, which is this employer, and you're relying on them, you know, 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week, whatever, then you're probably more of an employee. So, again, saying probably because all these situations have to, all these factors need to be taken into consideration. So the fifth thing on the current Department of Labor's application of the economic reality test is the amount of initiative, judgment, or foresight required for the success of the claimed independent enterprise. So basically, if it's somebody, I don't want to say who's not educated, because I don't mean that in an official sense. I don't mean that like a college degree or a high school degree. But if they're being taken advantage of because of their lack of knowledge and the employer is saying, no, you're an independent contractor, and they don't have that judgment or that education, then the courts are probably going to look at it and say, you know what, no, this employee should, you know, on number five, should be leaning towards the employee side. So there's that on there. And then the last thing is the permanency of the relation. So the relationship. So what that means is, like I said, if you're an independent contractor and you've worked with this company for, you know, 10 years, you still might be an independent contractor, especially if you have other clients. But if that's their only client and it's permanent no matter what, you're getting a paycheck from them no matter what, even though it's not an official paycheck, it's more of a, you know, an invoice payment, then they're going to lean towards, okay, we need to look into more of the other steps. So they're the six very confusing steps.
Yeah, because some of those things that you mentioned are really not an employer responsibility, right? The number of of customers that an independent contractor has is really more up to the independent contractor than the employer. But the employer has to be aware of these things because they might be misassigning them as an independent contractor, and they need to be made an employee because they're spending most of their time or all of their time with that one company. So, yeah, that's really fascinating where the responsibilities lie.
Yeah, and like you just said, you know, this isn't all on the employer, but the employer needs to know that there's these laws out there, and a handshake deal is, you know, it's going to be good. It's going to be good for both parties. A little handshake deal says, yeah, you're a contractor, until something goes wrong. And then in that employee, or that worker, I should say, gets cut from the project or cut from something, and they say, we don't want to work with you anymore. And then the employee goes, oh, I'm going to go get unemployment. They're like, no, you don't get unemployment because you haven't paid taxes on unemployment. And, you know, how that's when the lawsuits happen. Or when an you know, when we have an economic recession or something like that. And then they go like, hey, I don't have any money. I got to go after this employer and sue them because I should have been a W-2 employee the whole time and I wasn't. And now I want to make my money back.
Right.
When things are good, when the economy is good, when work's good, when the relationships are good, everyone's happy. It's when the relationship isn't good or something's going on that the employee gets, the worker gets desperate and then says, okay, I'm going to go sue you. Or a different contractor turns them in. Now there's a, you know, a big lawsuit on behalf of many people, even though you're saying, no, I want to be an independent contractor. It's not up to you. It's up to the law. It's up to the court.
So how would you rate the current environment? And let's compare it to, let's say, you know, the big, internet bubble back in 2000, 2001, or the big, you know, economic downturn we had in 2007, 2008, or the COVID, you know, from 2020 or so. How would you rate the current environment as far as how many lawsuits are going on trying to challenge, you know, the status as an independent contractor compared to those sort of, you know, bad times?
Well, what I would say is right now everybody needs workers. And so I don't, you know, like if somebody's out there and can't find a job and then they're saying, okay, I'm going to, you know, sue my former employer or something like that, I'd love to know why they can't find a job. It's got to be them because there's so many job openings right now. We don't have enough humans that have the knowledge, skills, and abilities that we need to do the current jobs that have openings. And so most companies are working with a shortage of workers right now. Everybody that's working, whether you're a contractor, you're, you know, a business, whether you're an employee, everybody has more than enough on their plate and would welcome even having an independent contractor work right next to them. And so, I mean, it was predicted that because of COVID, we were going to go into a recession. And yeah, you know, we were hurting for a little bit there. A lot of people died. But what it really came out of it is more job openings than ever. I would say, you know, I'm an HR consultant. I do recruiting for my clients and everybody's filling jobs. When we hear on the news, oh, there's been a layoff, there's this or there's that, is very rare, and then the news makes a big story about it. And it's usually like somebody you either overhired, which a lot of companies had to overhire during the COVID period because COVID was affecting that industry. But now with COVID, I'm not saying going away, but, you know, it's less and less. The companies that had to overhire are now laying off. But those employees are finding new jobs and they may have to, you know, change some knowledge, skills and abilities and go into a different industry. But I don't foresee the hiring slowing down anytime soon. I really don't.
Gotcha. Well, that's good to hear. Of course, I guess I look at two different factors. One of them is geography. You know, there might be an employer that is across the country and you don't want to move or, you know, you can't afford to move. And then also you may not have, like you mentioned, the skills, the knowledge that's necessary for a particular job. And those are probably a couple reasons why a lot of jobs are not being filled right now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's funny. It's not really funny, but, you know, we always, you know, oh, kids these days or, you know, people don't want to work. And listen, every generation's different. And as we continue to get older, younger generation comes behind us, and then we make fun of them. We were made fun of
right.
At one point. They were made fun of at one point. I always tell the youngest generation, don't worry, somebody else coming along will make fun of them. But full change, and especially since COVID, people do not want to be abused anymore. They don't want to be working 80 hours a week for a 40-hour paycheck. They want their life back. They want, especially the youngest generation, they're lucky if they're even going to be able to afford a house. And so they're like, listen, if I'm going to be working full time, that's it. I'm working 40 hours or less, and that's it, and you're not getting any more. And there's nothing, if everybody's saying that, even older workers are saying, no, I'm not working more than 40 hours a week or 50 or whatever it might be, then we, if I went from working from 60 hours a week, me and all my peers, and then we all went to work 40 hours a week, it's not like the business got busier. Maybe they did, but you just are not able to abuse those workers anymore. And now you have to hire. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And but the companies are like, man, it costs us so much. And it's like, well, yeah, but you kind of were taking advantage of everybody for a very long time. So I'm not feeling sorry for you.
especially the salaried employees, right? If you're, and we'll get into that too, because you brought that up to me via email. And I want to get into that too, because that's very interesting. Some of the new, dollar amounts that go into salary versus hourly.
I'll jump into it right now. So it was just announced.
I was going to say, if you want to finish this up or if you want to move on, either way is fine.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the independent contractor situation, you know, you just have to do your due diligence. And if it changes again, we're going to have to do the same thing. You know, unfortunately, these laws change with different presidents, you know, Republican, Democrat. It goes back and forth. And it drives me crazy because it's like, okay, whoever's in charge this, you know, this year or this, you know, 4 or 8 years, then we're going to be flipping back and forth. And it's not fair to businesses. It's not fair to workers. Like, let's just stick with the rule and move forward. These laws that are changing right now, including the Department of Labor, the independent contractor one, and then the one that I'm about to talk about for the exempt salary amount changes, is more pro-employee, where it's always, business has always in the United States been about pro-employer. And it's right now kind of switching a little bit, but in the big picture, like in the really big picture, it's still pro-employer. You know, that's what the United States is. It's pro-business. And even if these laws didn't change, the salaried one that I'm going to talk about in a second, even if they didn't change, people are demanding that there was a change even without the law. So what I mean by that is just this week, it was announced that Department of Labor changed the exempt salary amount. And so it currently is, so it's changing July 1st, 2024. Interesting thing, it's changing again on January 1st, 2025. And so in a couple months, like right now, if you're hiring somebody and you're saying, okay, we already know they're a worker, they're not an independent contractor, are they going to be an hourly employee or are we going to be a salary employee? Okay, we want them to be a salary employee because that's what all my employees are, or, you know, everybody in this role is salaried. So today, you have to pay them a minimum of $35,578 per year. Jobs are paying more than that because employees are like, no, I'm not working for you salaried and going to be getting paid, you know, we'll just say $35,500. Like, no way. Most jobs, you already have to pay a lot more. So this law is even irrelevant in many jobs, not all. Well, that's changing July 1st from $35,578 a year to $43,888. And then it's changing again.
Yeah, that's flat across the country too, right? So there's some areas that are very high, you know, living expense areas where $35,000 is not going to do much for you, whereas there's other lower cost areas where $35,000, I wouldn't say it's a lot of money, but, you know, you can certainly do better, much better, in a lower cost of living area. So it's interesting that one number goes across the whole country, even though the cost of living in different states is pretty different if you go from one extreme to the other. So it's
exactly. I mean, I'm in the state of Florida, and if, you know, 7 years ago, that would have been great. Now, Florida's one of the highest cost of living. So it's like that, no, people want more. But that's why I was saying, like, even though the law currently is $35,500, but it's moving to $43,888, most jobs are still going to have to pay more anyways, or nobody's going to take the job offer, you know?
Exactly,
And then on top of that, here's the interesting thing, is on January 1st, it's going from 43,000, almost 44,000, to $58,656. So what they're basically, the law basically is going to force many companies to do is move the people that are salaried to hourly. And as long as you're not using them and abusing them and having them work for, you know, 45, 50, 60, 80 hours, then who cares? You just move them to hourly, but you have to move everybody that's in the same role to hourly. So, because everybody has, if you're in the same exact role, you should be getting paid the same way. So,
yeah, now
my understanding
is salary versus hourly was really based on what is your job function. You know, if you were someone that was doing the actual work, you're hourly. If you're a supervisory type, you're salary. That's how I normally split it out as far as who
should
be
salary. No, that's not 100% accurate. That's partially accurate. If you're a manager, you can be salaried, but there's all these different types of salary. There's professional, there's highly compensated exemption, there is sales, there's some other ones too. But this is the best way that I can get people to understand it. If you're doing any kind of physical work, you're hourly, period. Even if you're a manager and you're doing, but if you're only managing 20% of the time, then you're going to be hourly. You know, so it is a percentage. But the bottom line is you could just move everybody back to hourly. But if they work over 40, you got to pay them time and a half. So
right.
I see a lot of companies are going to move a lot of their employees to hourly because then they only have to comply with the minimum wage in the area that they work and live. And then if they work over 40 hours, they have to pay them time and a half. So this is a way to get people more money, either stop being abused and or getting paid overtime if you want them to work 50 hours a week, then they get paid overtime for those 10 hours. And then here's another kicker too for our listeners is then in 2027, there's going to be updates every 3 years on that $58,000 amount. So it'll be interesting to see where this all goes. And it's I know a lot of companies, you know, there was a big change like 2 years ago, I want to say, and then it got canceled at the last minute. So a lot of companies already made the changes and they couldn't take that, you know, money back. So this was well needed. The salaried amounts were so low. It was just embarrassing low to even offer a professional who has a four-year degree $35,000. You know, I could see if you're right out of college, maybe, but if you have 10 years of experience, like really? But like I said, the market's kind of like already running above this. So this law, I don't see it as affecting as many companies as we think because they're already paying a lot more than that. Now, the January amount, though, is huge. So you have between now and January to figure out how am I going to pay almost $60,000 or switch them to hourly. And if you're not willing to pay overtime, then you have to hire more people.
Right. Yeah, it'll be a real complicated decision, right?
Yeah, and if you're wanting to hire a contractor,
you
got to make sure that they're not supposed to be an employee.
Yeah.
So Wendy, real quick, is there an employee number that this starts at? Like for businesses with over 100 employees, all these things apply, or does this apply with employee number one?
Yeah, it applies to. I want to say, I think it's all employees. I'm looking right now. I should know this off the top of my head, but it's a Saturday evening and I'm brain dead at this point.
Nope. This conversation takes a total different turn if it's for employee number one versus if it's for employee, if you have over 500 employees or more. So
it's going to be a majority of businesses. It's not for like 500, you know, employees. It's you know, it's covering like, you know, millions and millions and millions of businesses, never mind just employees.
Yeah, what I'm referencing, like, for instance, I'm going to think about me. So when I was a manager at Electrolux, the vacuum cleaner place, we would have a secretary, a service manager or two, and I'm thinking, okay, well, those were employees, and then I'd have my independent contractors, which were our sales guys, and, you know, and then are you telling me I have to pay Louise, the secretary, at the $50,000 rate? Are you kidding me? Seriously?
Well, a secretary would never qualify for salary exemption. A secretary would pretty much always be hourly. So then you just pay the minimum wage or more, or whatever, you know, she's willing to accept. So the people that small businesses may not comply. I got the 3 points here. So a covered enterprise for the Fair Labor Standards Act. So the Fair Labor Standards Act is the overtime act. And so where you're either going hourly or salary. A covered enterprise is someone whose annual gross volume of sales made or business done is not less $500,000. So if you're a small business and, you know, you don't make $500,000, then your employees, and I'm saying may because this is the federal law. Your state law might say, yep, so this is a federal law. Another one is you may not have to comply with this if you're, I think it's in a hospital. Yeah, a hospital, mental hospital, a regular hospital, preschools, high schools, I think colleges as well. And so education and hospitals may have an exception too, but it does depend on, again, also that $500,000 test. And then if they're a public agency, like the government, but that's because they just have their own version of the FLSA. So I don't even like pay attention to that third one there because people be like, oh, government doesn't have to pay it. No, they have their own laws that they have to comply to. So small businesses may not have to, again, comply with this, but like your example with the administrative assistant, they're never going to be salaried anyways, ever. They never qualify as salary. So you just pay them hourly.
For instance, and we're not debating this. I'm just kind of asking the questions. I'm taking a look at this. How would I react to this if I was that owner? Like, we always had our, you know, our service managers at a specific salary. You know, this is what they made per week, or this is what they made every other week. And it was never hourly, you know, and they just kind of did the work. And, you know, if they had to work over, sometimes they worked over, and they probably, you know, we never paid overtime, but we obviously, that would have been a violation, of course, but we're talking about real world stuff. And then if I had to hire, like, we had this guy Schmutz, you know, was a guy who basically cleaned the office. Would I have to worry about Schmutz if he was 40 hours or more? I'm not going to pay this high school kid $53,000 or $35,000 at anything. It's just crazy. So I'm taking a look at
but
the impact.
But he would never qualify. That high school kid would never qualify as a salaried employee. So if people had that high school person as a salaried employee, they were doing it illegally to avoid overtime anyways. So a lot of these situations, like you're bringing up, it's like, no, they would have never qualified. I know people pay them that. People think, oh, I'm on salary. I'm so important. It's like, no, they're screwing you, man. I'm sorry, but that's what's happening is they're trying to not pay you overtime. So they made you a salaried employee, and they're abusing you. That's really what it's coming down to. So if you Google for our listeners, there is a whole list on the Department of Labor's website, but you could just Google who is covered FLSA, and there's a list there of who's not covered, who like child labor, education, there's things with communication people and like domestic service workers, like house cleaners and stuff like that. There's all these exceptions. So there's a ton of exceptions of a bunch of things for Department of Labor, and industries are one of them. The conversation that we're having today is very high level and generic. So just sure you always look, you know, at the industry, because there are a lot of very specific industry laws that you may not know until you stumble upon a lawsuit and you're like, oh, okay, this is why. And here's the other thing, too. There's a law and then there's lawsuits. And so a result of a lawsuit now de facto becomes a law, you know, but it's never really a law. So if somebody gets sued, a company gets sued for something, they lose. Now all the other companies say we have to change our policy because that company lost, and now we have to change it because we'll lose if you know, we go to court. So it is very complicated, you know, running a business and being HR, especially in 2024. And then add on this all this COVID stuff and all these laws changing, it is nuts.
Yeah, I can imagine. It keeps you busy.
Yes, I am very busy, for sure. Like I said, I have my own podcast as well. I have two podcasts, and I have books and on YouTube and everything. So if anybody ever needs my help, just look me up, Wendy Sellers, VHR lady. I'd be more than happy to help you. And I love to do management training so we could train all of our managers to keep us out of court.
Right, right. Now, I guess a company could decide to challenge it. Court ruling, you know, that was determined by a different company, if they wanted to appeal that to a higher court, but then they have to make that decision, you know, is this worth appealing, or do we just need to fall in line with this precedent decision? So it gets really complicated, you know, from an HR and legal business standpoint, you know, what you do with any given situation.
Yeah, it really does. And I'm actually honestly quite shocked at the this decision to change the salary amount so high. I think it was absolutely needed, but so many businesses relied on, and I'm just going to put it bluntly, on paying their workers as least amount as possible. And you could still do that. You just got to pay them hourly and then pay them overtime if they work overtime.
Yeah, I used to work at an electric utility, and I was a supervisor, but I had a lead technician that put in lots of overtime because he was just so knowledgeable, and he usually made more money than I did. You know, I got to contribute my hours for free, as I would say it, because I was salaried. You know, so if I had to do overtime, then so be it. There was no extra money coming in, but he was constantly on overtime because it was a very technical, you know, situation, and we needed him because he was the guy that had all that, you know, corporate knowledge, so to speak. Even if you're an hourly, it doesn't mean you're going to make less than, you know, your supervisor or manager that's on salary, because those are the special cases where, and I'm not complaining in any way either. The guy knew his stuff and he deserved it. Yeah, that's a real situation where, you know, someone that was at a lower level theoretically was actually making more money because of the overtime.
Right, right, exactly. So, yeah, a lot to think about for those listeners that are, you know, running a business or you're just a worker as well. You know, you have to make sure that, first of all, I see a lot of companies are going to try to switch them to independent contractors. You need to understand those six, you know, steps or factors if they're an independent contractor or an employee. And then if they are an employee, which most are probably going to be more an employee than an independent contractor because of the last ruling. And then now you have to pay the minimum wage. And if you want them to be salaried, it better be a much higher amount. Otherwise, you got to pay them hourly and then figure out how am I going to pay them overtime if I don't have the money to do so. So it definitely is, you know, it's going to be a lot harder to run a business. I'm happy about it, though, because I see so many people being abused in the workplace and don't know their rights. And now it's the law. It's not a choice.
Yeah, although, you know, those six factors you mentioned, to me they're subjective, where you can say, well, I think this factor is more important, therefore they're independent contractor, someone else has a different opinion saying, well, I think this other factor overrules that and they should be an employee. So how do you, I guess the only way you can resolve that is go to court, right?
No, you can hire a consultant like me and we can work it out ahead of time, or an employment attorney as well. And so, you know, I would suggest that everybody dust off all of their job descriptions or their contractor descriptions, you know, your agreement, and say, okay, let's just go pretend we were going to court and let's figure this out here. And if there's any, you know, if there's even a little bit of inch, like, I don't know, we're not leaning 100% towards employee or contractor, well, then you might want to get a second or third opinion, because it'll be cheaper to pay them as an employee than to end up on, you know, CNN or in court and, you know, all the back pay. Because if you ever do get audited by the Department of Labor, let me tell you, they don't just go after one person. They open up everything, and then they go back. I think the Department of Labor goes back, I want to say, 3 years normally.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah, so you don't even want to crack that book open, right? You want to keep it shut, because once it's cracked open, then the Department of Labor might come in and look at everything.
Exactly. Or just even not even Department of Labor. It could just be one of your workers gets an attorney, and now you have to give them access to everything. And then, you know, it could be a class action suit. So it doesn't always have to be the Department of Labor. It could be a private attorney as well. You know, so it's definitely, if anybody is listening and thinking, I might have some concerns, then you probably need to, you know, print out all your roles and be like, all right, let's go through these economic reality tests, and then let's go through the overtime situation as well. How much is this going to cost me if I move people to employee, to hourly employee, from contractor to employee, and then, you know, probably an hourly employee, versus how much is it going to cost me if I get busted?
Yeah, and certainly the company can restructure the job description and the responsibilities to sort of push it in one direction or the other as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's a lot of moving parts here. I don't know how much you know about multi-level marketing, but I'm aware that there's a lawsuit in California where this guy said, I was in Amway, I was treated as an independent contractor, but I think I should have been treated as an employee. Now, this is probably at least 2 or 3 years old. I don't know if it predated 2021, but I guess
it was 2019.
Another secondary question would be, if they haven't gone to trial yet, which law should be applied? What was in effect when he made the complaint, or the current law?
It'll be what was in effect at the time the person was working. So that was in 2019. But the lawsuit actually started, I think, in 2007. So
has it been open that long? Wow.
Yeah, I'm looking at it on findlaw.com right now. And it did say that Amway agreed to settle a suit.
Yeah, Emily likes to settle.
well, a lot of companies.
I mean,
like to
they're smart. They don't want the publicity. I get it. It's like any other company. You know, let's just settle and, you know, forget it. So that one has been settled, then, huh?
Oh wait, that was another one actually with Amway. This one was in 2020. For direct salespeople. I don't know if they. No, that was a different one that they settled. I don't know if they settled this one.
Yeah, I think
don't know
2021
if this one was settled.
Yeah, I think that one is still open.
The ABC test. So the ABC test was the previous test for independent contractor, and there it says in here that they're using the ABC test as in the lawsuit. So I don't know if it was settled, though, or not yet. But, you know, usually when something like that is, comes into play, now that kind of whatever the result is kind of becomes de facto law. But it could just be for that state. And California is a very unique state for employers.
Yes, it is. Very unique, yes. I mean, do you have any sense of a typical MLM distributor, if they should be treated as an employee versus what they are now, independent contractors?
You know, I mean, it's hard for me to say, because when we give people, even in a regular company, when we give somebody a job title, or, you know, a title doesn't mean anything. It's what they're actually doing that means something. You know what I mean? So were they salespeople for themselves, or were they a salesperson for the, you know, for the company? Because there's actually a sales salary exemption as well. So I would need to know really more of what do they actually do. And the other thing I wanted to say is, even if you signed an agreement, like, oh, I'm here, Amway and Wendy, we're going to sign this agreement and you're a contractor, that agreement doesn't mean anything if it violates the law.
Right. Right. Well, just to give you a little bit of background, typically in an MLM, you're not forced to do anything. You can work as hard as you want, or as little as you want. It's really up to you. Now, you're going to be encouraged, of course, you know, by your, what they call upline, the people that got you involved, to put a lot of effort into it. But ultimately, it's your decision how much effort to put into it. So to me, that would make it lean towards an independent contractor, which it is currently. Do you have any thoughts on that aspect of it?
So I'm looking at this case, which I believe is a similar one, that Dynamex, that the Amway case referred to. And it says in here, the court first found that the suffer or permit to work standard was held. And so that was, I think it was like the third one that I was talking about before, of like, if they're not being forced to work, but they, depending on it, if they can't choose how much they get to work, then they're going to be an employee. Knowing a little bit of what I know about, you know, MLMs, I would think they're independent contractors. I really would, even going over the factors we just went over. But I'm
that
not
would
the
be
court,
my
so.
Sense too. That would be my sense too. Of course, you know, anyone can, as you know, anyone can sue anybody for any reason or no reason at all in this country. So it's one of those things.
Yeah.
You know, just because you're suing somebody, maybe you're trying to, you know, shake them down to settle so they're not, you know, in the news. That goes on all the time with lawsuits. But yeah, my sense has always been that MLM distributors should be independent contractors. But that's why we have you on the show, is to look at those six factors. And if you have any questions about the six factors as they apply to MLM, you know, maybe we can help you answer those sort of questions. Are there any of those six factors you're not sure about as far as how MLM works, and you know, which way you would lean on any of those factors beyond the hours and so forth? Because that really is something that I think is an open shut case. I can tell you from personal experience, we sponsored lots of people that didn't do anything. I didn't have any control over them. I could encourage them, but I couldn't force them. There was no, you know, contract.
The biggest thing that my biggest concern with these new six factors would be the extent to which the work performed is an integral part of the potential employer's business. You know, if without these workers, would the business make any money?
Typically, the answer would be no, or if they made money, it would be very little. You know, there might be a very small percentage of customers that would order off the website, but generally all or most of the products are being either purchased by the distributors, which is an issue I covered earlier, or for those customers that do exist, they're produced by the distributors, not by the company. And so to me, that's pretty integral. I mean, the, you know,
yeah.
when you go to have a business, if you can't sell it, that's pretty integral in my mind. I don't know, again, how the law looks at that. Maybe that's not considered integral, but I can tell you that most MLM companies, if the distributors went away, the sales would go away and the company would fold. Peter, I don't know if you have any different perspective on that, but that's my perspective.
Yeah, I'd say that the first of all, the MLM world would be 100% 1099s. There's no way anybody can convince the courts that independent distributors, as far as the sales guys that are doing the stuff for MLM companies, would be employees. Only possible exception might be upper level people that are also kind of acting as corporate people. They might be partially maybe employees or might have a dual role, but the typical person joining an MLM would be a 1099, without a doubt. And some of these rules are just, you know, I take a look at some of this stuff, Wendy, and I'm like, who the hell makes these things up? Like, why do they make these things up? Who makes these things up? And maybe they should get into the real world, because a lot of these things are really just screwing things up. Like, they're adding confusion. This makes no sense in a lot of situations. It might make sense in big companies. You know, like if you're in Boeing or United Airlines, or maybe you're a big company like whatever, a railroad company like a union, you know, something like that. Maybe some of this stuff applies. But it really puts pressure on the small businesses, like the mom-and-pop shops, and anything under 100 employees. All this stuff just really messes things up. And we throw away, we throw around words like, well, it's going to be settled in court. Like, are you freaking kidding me? Are you freaking kidding me? Like, just going to court, and anybody who's been sued by an MLM company knows that the legal fees are kind of exorbitant. Well, I mean, to settle this in court, what the hell does that mean? Do you really think, as a small business owner, I want to spend my next $100,000 defending whatever kind of thing? Get the hell out of my business, government, is my basic thing. So that's why I was kind of curious to see, is there a threshold on the number of employees? And for all those people that are listening in, I mean, these things are, and I'm so biased, I'm so pro-small business and so biased big business. When they were doing the PPPs, you know, for those people that were doing the paycheck protection, I'm like, okay, well, that sounds like a good deal. You know, the government's going to help us out. Well, you say, well, definition of a small business. I know you know this, but our Building Fortunes Radio listening audience probably doesn't know this. If I were to ask every single person listening in that doesn't already have a background in this, how big is a small business before it is considered kind of like a business, like a big business? And if you had like 10 employees, would you consider yourself a small business? And the answer would probably be yes. If you had 100 employees, would you consider yourself a small business? And the answer would be, I don't think so. I don't think I'd be promoting myself as a huge business, but I might not call it a small business. Well, by the government's definition, small businesses, 500 or less. Let me tell you, if I have 500 employees and you call me a small business, you're going to get socked in the nose. I mean, what the hell? 500?
It depends on the topic, right? It depends on the topic because, you know, this Department of Labor stuff we've been addressing might have a different quantity of employees versus the PPP program versus another program.
Right.
They all have their definitions of what the minimum employees are. And you have to really know all these details to figure out which one applies to any scenario. So it really is complicated.
The right hand and the left hand of the government are not talking. And so I don't know what's going to happen with multi-level marketing, because, like I said, that one line in there to me gives me concern of integral to the business. So I guess we just got to wait and find out.
You're absolutely right. It's one of those things. So a class action suit ambulance chaser lawyer is going to go, you know, find a big company like Herbalife, like Doug Brooks did. So you don't know who Doug Brooks is, but Doug Brooks, you know, found Herbalife. They go after a class action lawsuit because they have the money, just to get the settlement because of this vague thing that you just referenced. So every legal department for every big MLM company should be on notice, because we all know that if you're going to try to sue a publicly traded company not going to want to go through the discovery, the lawsuit, blah, 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 blah. So if you're an ambulance chaser lawyer, then you're going to go out and do a class action lawsuit against somebody using that one clause, the one that you're referencing right there. That could be the one. And as a result of that, they're going to try to get a settlement. And the settlement, you know, like Doug Brooks got a $15 million settlement from a multi-billion dollar company, which is kind of a weak settlement. But I'm sure stronger lawyers are going to go after stronger settlements. And that's just not right. I mean, that's just not right. So, you know, I don't know which administration pushed this law, but they didn't button it up as much as they possibly should have, in my humble opinion.
Well, so, you know, Peter, $15 million is not a large amount of money as far as a settlement, but I'll bet you Doug Brooks made about a fourth to a third. You know, he made, you know, $4 to $5 million out of that probably, just that one case. So it's very lucrative for the attorneys. And I guess that's just another question. Even if that one of the six factors indicates that you should be an employee because you're integral to the operation of the business, there's five other factors to consider. So now the question is that one factor override the other five? Who knows? I mean, it's all so subjective. How do you even make a decision on that, except for what you said earlier, Wendy? You know, you have to look at precedent and see if, you know, perhaps there's been trials and you know, that particular factor was deemed to be more dominant than the others. Of course, we have a brand new law now in 2024, so it hasn't even been tested in court as far as, you know, all of these six factors are now sort of co-equal versus the two dominant ones that we had in the earlier law. So, yeah, it's a big, very complicated scenario. So I can see why you're pretty burned out by Saturday evening.
Yeah, these humans, you know.
Yeah. It's just ridiculously complicated. It is amazing. And then, like you said earlier, Wendy, this is the federal stuff. Every state has their own stuff, too. Now, there aren't any local laws, are there? It's just federal and state?
No, there's local, too.
Oh, my gosh.
Yep, there's local, too. There could be county. There could be city. I mean, especially in California, there's down to cities even have their own, pay rates and everything. So just for our listeners, follow me on LinkedIn or on any of the social medias or YouTube, or check out my podcast, The HR Lady, and I'll do my best to keep an eye on this multi-level marketing to see if there's any lawsuits with the independent contractors, and then, you know, just going back to the hourly versus salary pay too. But that one factor is my biggest concern for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So,
well,
Wendy, which administration pushed this new law? Well, I'm sure, I know it was not the Trump administration. There's no way
world
it was Trump.
I really don't know. I would assume it's the current one, since this is when it got passed. So I don't really know. It had to be. It had to be if they just rolled it out and, you know, post-Trump. So it could have been something that has been going on, you know, been looking at for decades, for all I know. I don't keep an eye on that because every time I click on a government website, I get upset. So I just like, okay, somebody just inform me when this stuff's coming.
Crazy.
It is crazy. Yeah, it's amazing. Well, Wendy, we're kind of coming towards the end of our time period here, but I try to ask my guests before we finish, was there anything you were thinking of before the show started that we haven't talked about, or something that popped up in your mind during the show that you'd like to comment on? But I really appreciate you being on here, and if there's anything you'd like to add, go right ahead.
Sure. Don't want to get into it because we'd be here for another hour. I do want to warn everybody, though, that they may want to be checking the news and following what's going on, that the U.S. government just announced that they are going to be banning non-competes. Again, if you're an independent contractor, that doesn't matter because this is really about employees. But there has been a national ban that was just announced this week on non-competes. However, it's going to court, so we don't know if it's going to what's going to happen with that. So just keep an eye on that.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. That was an FTC decision, Federal Trade Commission, and the information I've seen on that, it is brand new, but the information I've seen on that is the impact on MLMs is that MLMs will no longer be able to confine you either when you leave an MLM to join another one, and there are rules in place right now. It's individual to each MLM. For example, in Amway, you can't join another MLM for 6 months, and then for 2 years after you leave Amway, you can't contact a current Amway distributor. And so with that non-compete, ruling, I guess you could say, from the FTC, which I agree with you, it's going to be challenged in court.
There's already lawsuits filed the day it went live.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not, if I could read the future, I wouldn't be here talking to you guys on a Saturday night.
the other thing that might happen is you can join multiple MLMs at the same time, because a lot of MLMs have prohibitions against that. You know, if you're going to be with us, you got to be with us only. And then that non-compete from an MLM perspective would allow people to be members of multiple MLMs. So, on two different aspects, that ruling does affect MLMs. And, it's definitely going to go into the courts. And
I would just keep an eye on the news, because we'll see what the real result is. It doesn't go into effect for, I think, 4 months anyway. So we have some wiggle room here to figure out what to do and see what these lawsuits are going to end up with.
Yeah, another really big area of that non-compete, from what I've seen, is the medical area. That a lot of doctors, for example, sign non-competes, which keeps them, with the hospital organization they're with, and really, probably, again, like you were saying earlier, it takes advantage of them. If they can't leave without, staying out of medicine for a certain period of time, then they'll tend to stay with that particular hospital outfit versus moving around, taking better deals, which would, of course, force the hospitals to pay them more to dissuade them from doing that. So it really has a lot of impacts both within MLM and outside of MLM. Then you get into the whole thing of, what do they call it? Not corporate intelligence.
Intellectual property.
Yeah, that's it, intellectual property. That's a pretty strong argument for the company to say, you can't be a free agent. We have a lot of knowledge that you have in your brain, and you can't hop around with that. So now you can also overcome that with NDAs and so forth, but still, it gets pretty messy, as far as enforcing things. So it's an interesting world, isn't it? But thanks for bringing that up. That's another hot topic that's going on right now.
Busy week.
but I wanted to, Peter, do you have any other final questions or comments for Wendy? We'll let her go here and let her enjoy the St. Petersburg evening.
No, Wendy did a great job. We want to make sure people can find you, so we're going to send out a guest link invitation for Wendy Sellers. So if you go to buildingfortressradio.com after we're done with this radio show sometime during the week, we'll make sure she puts up some stuff on the webpage. And then I'll communicate with her as well, because we have different websites where we can post this information for those people that are listening in. And we want to make sure that you get good information from great people. Wendy, we really appreciate you being a resource here. And I get so frustrated when I look at these types of things and I say, what are we doing here, government? What are we doing here? We're supposed to be trying to build build the country instead of tear down the country. Look at this confusion. Look at the things that you're doing. You're pro-big business, anti-big business, what the hell? Like, if I were running a business, I could run it somewhere else. I'd run it somewhere else. It would not be in this country. This country has lost my respect and the ability to get anything done. And if I come back next time, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a lawyer. Because they always have job security. They always have job security. And they have no patience.
Yep.
So I'd have to become I'd have to become somebody who just doesn't care. But I'd have a nice house and a big car. So crazy stuff. Lawyers. Oh my God. What is wrong with these people? How do they live with themselves? But anyway, so having said that, Wendy Sellers. Wendy, give us your website one more time.
It's thehrlady.com.
Thehrlady.com. So Scott, I'll let you wrap it up.
Okay, thanks. I just want to thank Wendy again. This has been a fascinating show because, you know, we often talk about MLMs pretty much as the main topic. This one touches on MLMs, but it also touches on everything else, you know, every other employer-employee type situation. So it's just been a fascinating show to learn from an expert. Obviously, she is. Just by listening to the show, you know she is. So, Wendy, I appreciate it. And, Peter, we'll see you next week.
Yeah, and one of the things we really didn't talk about. Yep, thanks. One of the things we really didn't talk about is a lot of MLMers are also independent contractors somewhere else. They're Uber drivers, they're Lyft drivers. They sometimes do Airbnbs. They do a whole bunch of other stuff that 1099s do because they're trying to make things work. So we'll see everybody next time on Building Fortunes Radio. Wendy, thank you. We'll see you next time, everyone.
You've been listening to Building Fortunes Radio on buildingfortunesradio.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out every Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for the designated Building Fortunes Radio segment with Peter Mingle. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website for our featured segments. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. At Building Fortunes Radio, we wish you the success you deserve and are willing to work for. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world.